stroke is the one specialty where you see enormous impacts of disease coupled with enormous benefit and care.
Welcome back to the Neurophilia Podcast, an atypical neurology podcast show focused on dispelling neurophobia one conversation at a time. We are your hosts, first-year neurology resident, Dr. Nuber Goyal, and adult neurology program director at the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Blake Bilecko. On today's episode of the Neurophilia Podcast, we are covering the highly anticipated topic of vascular neurology with Dr. Jim Sigler. After obtaining his bachelor degrees in neuroscience and history of science, medicine, and technology at Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Jim Sigler completed his medical education at Tulane University School of Medicine. He then completed his adult neurology residency and vascular neurology fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania. He currently serves as the inpatient medical director and director of the Comprehensive Stroke Center at the University of Chicago. Dr. Sigler's research interests include atherosclerotic disease, perfusion imaging, and eligibility of neurointervention for acute intracranial occlusion, for which he has published more than 200 peer-reviewed publications. Dr. Sigler is also a passionate medical educator. He is well known for previously producing an independent podcast titled Brainwaves, as well as the official podcast for the Neurocritical Care Society, American Academy of Neurology, American Neurological Association podcast, ANA Investigates, but more recently, he serves on the e-learning subcommittee of the AAN and helps produce their Neurobites, and he serves on the digital strategy team for the journal Stroke, Vascular, and Interventional Neurology, where you may have heard his voice on their podcast, Access. Jim, welcome to the Neurophilia Podcast. Dr. Bilecko and I are so excited and grateful to have you here to discuss vascular neurology.
Well, thank you so much, Nupur and Dr. Bilecko. This is really exciting and giving me so many flashbacks of when I was in your shoes not even 10 years ago. I feel like I've done exactly what you've done, and it's weird being on the other end of the microphone.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you here and to have a fellow podcaster. So I think we're going to have a wonderful hour together. The first thing that we wanted to ask you about, and this is something we ask all guests that come onto the show, is telling us about your journey into neurology and what got you excited and eventually made you choose vascular neurology as your subspecialty.
You know, I would be remiss to say that it was obvious that I was going to go into neurology. I was always fascinated by it. You know, I majored in neuroscience as an undergraduate in Baltimore, but I was just drawn to acute care needs from a very early age. I mean, a lot of us probably did lifeguarding or some sort of equivalent, but I got to do some really exciting lifeguarding at you know, water parks and you know, crazier places where we saw some, you know, actual you know, high risk situations. And I remember one of my earliest patients, I would say, that I treated, I must have been 15 or 16, way too early to be doing something like this. It was a girl who was riding one of those razor scooters, and she got the back of her foot caught between the brake apparatus of the scooter and the wheel, and it cut her leg pretty wide open. And she was bleeding so much that I really did need to apply pressure. And without getting into all the gruesome details, I remember all these adults swarmed around me, and I'm just, you know, little scrawny 15-year-old, but they, you know, were stunned and didn't know what to do. And I just immediately started barking out orders. I need you to find her mother. I need you to go get some bandages or some towels. I need you to, you know, like find some paramedics or call 911. And I was just dishing out orders left and right while at the same time trying to calm this girl down who was just in shock that this kind of thing was happening. Luckily everything worked out well for her, and she wrote me a really nice note a month later. And I think that her family still goes to church with my mom, but, it was a really rewarding experience that, I guess I continue to pursue something like that, with a career. I didn't know that neurology would be the end goal, the end game, but it was always something that I was naturally drawn towards. As a neuroscience undergrad, I got to sacrifice a lot of mice in mice labs and do a lot of basic cellular analyses and research there. But I always thought I would go into internal medicine and think of the body as a whole, and I was approaching more of a holistic medicine subspecialty probably in my earlier years. But I got interested in some got involved in some very early stroke research with Dan Hanley's lab at Hopkins. After that, when I went to medical school, the only active research program going on in neurology was with Dr. Cheryl Martinshield, who's still to this day one of my strongest mentors and closest friends, who was very active in a number of research projects. And she recruited me early on as an M1. But at that point, I was thinking maybe I'll go into orthopedic medicine just because I liked the physics of the body. That didn't work out. I really just felt more at home, more comfortable in neurology. And then in neurology, I flirted with the notions of, going to movement disorder specialty or epilepsy because I really liked EEG. And like we discussed before the podcast recording started, the neuromuscular medicine and inpatient neurology, neurohospitals medicine, everything seemed kind of interesting to me. But I continued with some stroke-related research in one form or another. Kept up with all my prior contacts at Tulane, grew a network of more collaborators at Penn, and my research career kind of pushed me in the direction of staying in the space of stroke. And I feel so lucky to have met so many bright people along the way that I wouldn't be happier in any other specialty.
Jim,
I apologize for that long-winded answer.
that's an incredible story. And I couldn't help when you were telling the story of when you were 15, responding to that emergency and having to come into a very chaotic situation where there is uncertainty, how that perfectly translates to your work as a stroke neurologist, where you're often responding to these acute situations, having to talk to nursing and pharmacy. And there's so much interdisciplinary work there that we'll obviously get into later on in this episode. But it's clear that from that moment as a 15-year-old, responding to acute emergencies was something that you were going to be called to do.
Yeah, it's something that you think is just a summer gig, and then it becomes, a real passion. So I felt lucky.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And, obviously, most people know that vascular neurology is a 1 year additional training period of time after you complete your neurology residency. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the structure of a vascular neurology fellowship. What does that training typically look like?
Sure. I think it's something that is pretty standard across institutions, but there are ways to mix and match it. And for me, for example, I worked at I trained in an institution where we were part of StrokeNet, and so there was a research StrokeNet fellowship here that I could add on to my clinical fellowship year. So I did that in addition to my clinical year. A lot of people are doing more interventional neurology as part of their stroke fellowship. So they'll do a year of interventional neurology or 2 years of interventional neurology and then a clinical vascular neurology fellowship. So you're seeing a lot of mixing and matching with that. Many people also do other research years, whether it's a T32 or some sort of R supported grant to get their research early career off the ground. But as far as the clinical vascular neurology fellowship goes, it's usually very heavily clinical. Where I trained, we did telestroke as well as inpatient and outpatient neurology. We had rotations, most of which were, I believe, optional with respect to neuroimaging, neurosonology, reading TCDs and carotid ultrasounds, and then also time in the neurocritical care unit, which is very minimal. So if that's not something that excites you, it's not something that you feel like, you'll have to really do a lot of, but it is something that you should be exposed to in your training. But the rest of it really is just inpatient neurology and learning the ropes as far as evidence-based medicine and how to personalize your treatment of stroke patients.
As a vascular neurologist, what are the typical conditions that you are helping to treat? Is it mainly stroke? What are you seeing on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so before I came to the University of Chicago, I was at Cooper University Healthcare, and it was a level one trauma center, a very big trauma program. So we saw a lot of traumatic brain injuries and a lot of intoxication substance use and stroke mimics. And I would say the same as what we see at the University of Chicago, where I've been for the almost last year. So a lot of it is quickly ruling in, ruling out stroke or a cerebrovascular event when it comes to seeing somebody coming through the door. Once they're in the hospital, then it's teasing out the etiology of the stroke that becomes the bread and butter of vascular neurology. Is it a clot that could have formed from the heart, or is it something that's more occult, maybe related to hypercoagulable states and genetic predisposition? Or there are some risk factors that we have not yet, really identified. And within my own interest in research space, we've been looking at the role of lipoprotein A in patients with subclinical atherosclerosis. We're looking at the microbiome with a couple of studies underway. And there's so much more to it than just thinking about atrial fibrillation and carotid stenosis that I think you learn as a med student or as a junior resident, which just makes it all the more exciting for the next 30 years of my career as we grow this specialty.
Dr. Bileko, typically when you're on these podcasts, you're usually acting as a co-host, but I was wondering if there is also additional things that you wanted to talk about in terms of conditions that you typically see as a vascular neurologist at the Cleveland Clinic.
Jim, gave a nice overview of what we do. And I think the interaction that we have with a lot of our medicine colleagues also might be a little bit different than some other subspecialties of neurology. We really rely on each other quite a lot. And I have a lot of shared appointments with cardiology, vascular medicine, vascular surgery. There's a lot of different people that are typically involved in some of these cases, especially the complex ones, which I kind of like a decent amount. The only other thing that I would comment on is one thing that really stood out for me about stroke is neurology has a lot of gray zone. And I feel like stroke gave me a little bit of black and white. I couldn't always tell somebody why they had a stroke, but I could at least use some imaging to allow me to have that conversation of whether or not somebody had a stroke and allow them to understand a little bit more of what was going on that I found different and unique from vascular versus some of the other subspecialties. I also like the continuum of care. So I get to see people from the moment that this happens, even pre-hospitalization through mobile strokes or telestrokes, all the way through long-term care of patients, years after they've had what's happened to them. So I really like being able to see people from the very, very, very beginning all the way through their recovery. It's always stood out to me about stroke.
And I think a lot of residents who go into stroke or who go into certain neurologic subspecialties, they have this angst or apprehension about going into outpatient neurology. And I wish to dispel any myths that you have about that, because I too had that same myth, and I wanted to be a neurohospitalist. I started a neurohospitalist program where I previously worked, and I'm still the inpatient medical director. But I love outpatient neurology. I feel like I really get to know patients and their families, the continuity of care, like you said, Blake, that's such a rewarding part of my day-to-day routine. And it's really not as tiresome as I felt it was when I was a resident, when I would have to duplicate all this effort within just a 30-minute time span of gathering the history, examining the patient, recapitulating it to an attending, and then coming back out, doing the same thing over and over again. It felt like it was a much slower process. And again, knowing that I wasn't going to be there for more than 2.5, 3 years, it was not something that I wanted to seek out a stronger relationship with these people here. Where I've been practicing, it makes a lot more sense to do that. And I have been doing that because you do have more control over it. So I don't want the residents or the trainees in the audience to feel completely disenchanted by outpatient neurology. I think there really is more to it than that, that it's hard to see until you become a faculty member.
Yeah, that's really well said. I was just having a conversation with some colleagues the other day about how I look forward to my clinic days now. And it's just a very different pace. It's a different environment. And the fact that we as stroke neurologists, we like to help people up front. We like to watch them get better before our eyes. But how much you can do even after the fact for a lot of these people that have not had many answers or are struggling to wrap their head around something, or you find something out that they have been struggling with for some time. It's equally as powerful as that acute stroke treatment, I agree.
There are two points that I wanted to touch on. Dr. Bileko, you had mentioned early on that the collaborations within the subspecialty of vascular neurology often differ than other subspecialties within neurology. Could you elaborate further? I know you mentioned cardiology, but who are the different types of medical professionals that you guys are often interacting with as vascular neurologists? And then secondly, I would love to learn more about the day in the life or a week in the life of a vascular neurologist.
Yeah, I think the ones that stand out, cardiology is clearly it stands out from an interventional cardiology standpoint to just a regular cardiology workup for a lot of our patients with comorbid disease. But you could add neurosurgery to that list, especially when we're talking about, kind of some complex situations or we're doing bypasses. I work with neuroradiology a ton. We are our own neuroradiologists, but we work with neuroradiology quite a lot. I work with my medicine colleagues a lot. A lot of what we do in the office is secondary stroke prevention. This is a lot of primary care. So sometimes I feel like I'm an internist in my day-to-day kind of clinical practice, but I enjoy things like that. And a lot of patients, I think, refer to me as their primary care physician. And then hematology, or what we have here at the clinic, is vascular medicine. So we're working with a lot of hypercoagulable disorders, potentially some malignancy kind of patients, with especially there being the sinus thrombosis patients. So it's quite a variety, but it's very rare that I'm just managing these patients just within neurology. It's usually at least one or two other providers in other fields that are helping me to manage their overall care. I don't know, Jim, if I missed anybody or anybody else that you're really interacting with day to day, but those are the ones that jump out at me.
No, I feel like the list honestly is almost infinite. I'm trying to put together a multidisciplinary clinic at the University of Chicago, incorporating a nutritionist and dietitian. We partner closely with interventional neurology and neurosurgery, and cerebrovascular neurosurgery with a lot of our multidisciplinary case conferences. Depending on your patient population, you might be working with oncology more. You mentioned, hematology. But oncology is a group that we work with respect to treatment of cancer-associated hypercoagulable states. A lot of these patients, they do have primary care doctors, but it's difficult, I think, for a primary care doctor within 15 minutes to address all of the needs of a patient that has uncontrolled vascular risk factors. And I don't know about you, Blake, but it is rewarding now that we can apply this new G22 code to our outpatient visits and actually get credit for this extra work that we end up doing with longitudinal care. I think this probably extends beyond the scope of what you were thinking for with this podcast, but we really are playing a significant role in pushing the needle forward for these patients to get their cholesterol under better control, to help them lose weight, to help them when they've reached the end of all their attempts at tobacco cessation and to have these harder conversations. I talk a lot about diet and lifestyle changes in my clinic. When the patient complains of back pain, it's not something that I say talk to your primary care doctor about. I'm giving them resources to do stretches to improve their range of motion and their stamina at home, because I know that that directly impacts their risk of major adverse cardiovascular events.
Yeah, and Jim, I'm sure that you and I have different answers as far as what our day-to-day looks like. But I think that there's some value in that, because I think that one of the reasons I love being a vascular neurologist, and sometimes why it's hard, is that there's a lot of variability in what our schedules might look like. So do you mind taking us through what a day looks like, or what a week or what a month might look like for everything that you're doing?
Yeah, sure. So I am 60% clinical. I have protected time as an inpatient medical director and a stroke director. And then I also have some additional protected time for research. Where I previously worked, I was working 26 to 30 weeks of service a year, which was a lot. And here I'm doing about 12 weeks of service per year. So that's 7 days on and then roughly 14 to 28 days off. Of service, and I do one full day of clinic per week, where half of those patients are my patients for as a primary provider for neurology, and then half the patients are resident or fellow patients. The rest of the week is populated almost certainly with meetings, and I've never seen meetings this frequently before. I feel almost overwhelmed by it, but I'm the kind of person who I work well with others, but I work well with others in parallel and not necessarily while we're in contact. So I'm good at being asked to do something and then I can get it done. And I'm good at delegating tasks, I think, and hoping that other people will do those in the same time frame, so we can get things done without having to interface as frequently. So I do a lot of meetings, but I also spend most of my time independently trying to move my agenda forward, move my projects forward. I'd say that a lot of my day is spent in Microsoft Outlook, but I also spend a fair bit of my time in Stata, looking at populations and analyses for various projects. working on the next grant or reapplying for a grant that didn't have a priority score that was funded. And then also addressing all of the needs within the healthcare system that I work. So whether it's expediting door to needle times, or it's trying to improve communication between the residents and the advanced practice providers and our stroke fellows, how can we improve our throughput in the ER, and our collaboration with the ER colleagues? I'm there to help navigate some of those conversations. And it's not like it's one simple thing. It's multiple small little details that come up periodically that just require a little bit of attention. What is your day like, Dr. Biletko?
Yeah, it's I'm 40% clinical and 60% within my PD role, and so I do two. Whenever I have a what I call a normal week would be kind of a Monday, Wednesday, Friday administrative. And again, to your point, my administrative days are usually a lot busier than any of my clinical days. So I remind the residents all the time that the administrative work that they're doing now with the emails, the surveys, et cetera, it won't end. It'll always be a part of what you're doing. But I will have a full clinic day on Tuesday and Thursday. One of those is usually a stacked resident clinic. But typically I have a night call of telestroke filter or, kind of added in there on some nights, whenever I'm, kind of finishing up a clinic or on a, kind of an administrative day. I will do random weekends of telestroke, and then I do a hospital service. We have two stroke services, an acute one and a primary one. So I rotate between both of those. And then I also rotate between general neurology, which people say I like to punish myself by doing that, but it's nice. I still love gen neuro and it gives me a way to work with the residents in a different environment than my normal stroke cat. So yes, it's extremely variable. Fortunately, we usually have our schedule many months in advance because there is so many moving parts and pieces, but my week is different. It's very rare that I have 2 weeks that look exactly the same. I can't remember the last time that I had that happen. So if you like variety, stroke is probably going to be able to provide that for you. If you really like your normal kind of 8 to 5, 9 to 5, I don't know many stroke neurologists that have a Monday through Friday, 8 to 5 schedule.
Yeah, I remember early on, talking about variety and the types of patients we see and the conditions that we treat. Early on, a mentor told me that neurologists are just internists who completed their training. I really think that vascular neurologists are just internists who completed their training. I feel like really we think about the heart, we think about the lungs, we think about the kidneys, we see and consider all these things. And for elements of care that are beyond our expertise, we call in help. And I think that you should whenever you experience that, just to get that expert opinion, because medicine changes rapidly. But you get to participate in all those aspects of care, which, I find very intellectually stimulating and rewarding.
Question that I wanted to ask, because I know Blake, you do a lot of telestroke call. Jim, do you also do telestroke?
I do. So we have a network of almost half a dozen hospitals at the University of Chicago, and we're growing it. We probably take 4 to 6 telestroke calls per day. Half of them we say are real strokes, where patients are coming in with measurable deficits that we would want to give a thrombolysis to or recommend for endovascular treatment. But with the growth of telestroke across multiple sites and smaller institutions, and lack of neurology expertise at some of these urgent care facilities and ERs, we're more often going to get phone calls about just an abnormal neuro exam, or somebody who is confused for any reason at all. And that can be difficult to parse out, and that can sometimes make you feel disillusioned about your specialty, because you really want to see vascular neurology and you want to give patients thrombolysis, you want to send them to the cath lab, and you're not doing that as much. But you got to remember that all of general neurology is fascinating, and you are likely to make a significant impact in this patient's life, even if they are altered because of sepsis or altered because, their kidneys are failing. You're there to kind of rule out some of the scarier things for them, and help out ER docs who really do need some help when they call for it. So we do a fair bit of telestroke, and we're trying to grow our telestroke program here at the University of Chicago. We're actually working on partnering with the United Arab Emirates through a contact of one of our local neuro IR stroke attendings, Dr. Tara Cass. So we're going to be working with the UAE on a telestroke platform using a pretty innovative set of goggles so that we can visually interact with the environment that provider is going to navigate us through. So pretty exciting stuff we're doing here.
If I could succinctly say how I feel about Telestroke in one statement, Jim, it would have been what you just said. So thank you for doing that for me, because it was much better said than what I would have tried to ramble off.
Have you noticed that the use and widespread nature and accessibility to Telestroke has changed a lot as a result of the pandemic? Or do you think that Telestroke has sort of been ahead of the curve in terms of teleneurology?
I think that it, I don't know that I would say it was ahead of the curve, but I think that neurologists were some of the earliest adopters of telemedicine, mostly because of the acuity of the patient population. You know, it's hard for a lot of providers outside of neurology to realize that every 1 minute of delay in thrombolysis, you know, can lead to several days of disability. And even more so for patients who are thrombectomy eligible. So it's hard to see that in somebody who's coming in and their arm is a little bit weak. And to us, like, that's a very disabling and serious event, and we can make a significant gains with those patients, even if we're not on site. So by deploying cameras or software or other hardware on site, we can interact and help those patients out. I really like it. I would say that, you know, I've gone back and forth with this. I remember early on, I wrote a opinion piece for Kevin MD. It was titled something to the effect of an apology from a telemedicine provider. And it was me saying how sorry I felt that I wasn't able to interact with a patient or their family during a serious life-threatening, life-altering event. You know, I felt very... I was almost grieving for the patients that I was treating the first year that I did Telestroke, because I felt like I couldn't really be there for them or have a physical presence like I'd been used to, like I'd been trained to, when dealing with a very serious event in this patient's lives. But I eventually flopped back across. I went to the other side of the pendulum swung the other way, basically, where I felt grateful that we're able to offer this to patients when there's not a neurologist on site. So while there are losses to this kind of an intervention, I think that it is still very helpful to many, many people.
Jim, that's important and beautiful insight. And, you know, obviously there are so many neurology residents that spend such a large portion of their training doing stroke. And I'm wondering, you know, such a large part of your job is coming into these acute situations, as we talked about earlier, where you're meeting people for the first time who are in very scary situations, and family members who also have no idea what's going on. Through all your time as a stroke neurologist, what have you learned about maintaining composure in acute neurological emergencies? And how do you build that rapport if it is very difficult, or if there's a screen in between you and the patient?
That's a great question, Nipur. And I think it took me, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years to realize this. You should always approach a situation under the assumption that that person is having a harder day than you. And I can't stress that enough. I think we go in as residents or as fellows, and we're exhausted, we're burnt out, we're seeing people dying. And it's honestly, it's a tragedy. And you're doing this 80 hours a week, you know, for weeks on end without vacation, without time off. And when you're on vacation, you're studying for boards, or you're not really getting time off. We know that's not paid time off. If you've experienced somebody in your family who's had a serious medical event, or if you've experienced a serious medical event, you know how difficult and trying it is. The loss that we have as healthcare providers is that we forget that when we think about ourselves. And like, while it's important to focus on your own mental health and mental energy, you still need to treat other people with respect and the way that they like to be treated, because they are probably going through a much worse situation than you are, especially if it is a stroke or suspected stroke. So if anything I could impress upon the listeners, it's, you know, treat other patients as if they're having a worse day than you are.
You know, Nuber, it's funny, because on all of our other kind of podcasts this year, I felt very similar to a lot of our guests with regards to the core kind of what we were talking about, interest in neurology. Jim, when you talk, I'm like, yes, that's exactly how I think about things. That's, you know, how I feel. very straightforward. I think too, I usually just try to remind patients right up front that there's going to be a lot that's happening. And we understand that you're going through a lot. And I promise you, as soon as we get done what we need to get done, I will sit down and we will go over everything. The families are also scared, and paying attention to the families is also very important, especially because we usually have to get some sort of consent, or we try to assent them for even simple things like the medications we want to give. So involving the whole family in a very short period of time with a lot of different emotions is very, very difficult. So even telling them and giving them some heads up of this is why we're moving so fast, but we're going to slow this down for you after the fact, I think is sometimes helpful. Jim, I was curious if we could switch gears just a bit, because I know that a big part of your journey, and I think a lot of people that have some affinity toward vascular neurology have interest in research. And potentially having some sort of clinician scientist as part of their DNA moving forward. You know, I always, whenever I see evidence-based medicine and the research that's coming out from the vascular side, I think, wow, we are so far ahead of a lot of our colleagues and other subspecialties. And then I run into one of my cardiology friends and they remind me that, you know, we're still 20 years behind some of what they've done in cardiology, and that we just steal all their stuff and you know, kind of take it from the heart to the brain. So, which might be an exaggeration, but they're not all wrong there. So I was curious if you could just comment on why you think vascular neurology is more evidence-based than some of our other subspecialties. What draws people into the research of not just acute stroke, but kind of protective therapies, rehab therapies? Why is this so much part of vascular neurology when we don't see this quite as emphasized in some other subspecialties?
That's a great question, Blake, and I totally get where you're coming from. I think we are 10 years behind our cardiology colleagues, whether it's alteplase, tenecteplase, catheterizations, GLP-1 agonists. I mean, we're constantly behind them, and the list goes on. I'm not sure why, and I think it'd be unfair to say that we are maybe at the forefront of the rest of the fields of neurology. I think that we have the advantages, as opposed to some of these other fields, of having honestly pretty cheap and effective interventions, a very large patient population to treat. You know, in the US, 800,000 patients a year have a stroke, and 12 million people die in the world every year because of a stroke. It's a big life-changing event for many people. So it's just all too common. And you know, for sites in the US, we have a lot of resources that we can explore outcomes related research, explore health disparities, and a lot of different aspects of epidemiology can be applied to our day-to-day routine. Whereas that's not the same for patients who have spinal muscular atrophy, or that's not the same for patients who have cortical basal degeneration or prion disease. We do have a lot more funding because it is affecting more people, and more people get funded for projects that may not pertain to their specific passions. You know, I remember it's kind of all about what's available to us, I think. I remember recruiting a young and very energetic M1 student at Cooper University Healthcare, one of my first years while I was practicing there, and she was looking for somebody to do vision research with, and she couldn't find an ophthalmologist there who was doing vision research. But she heard that I was doing some stroke-related research and asked, "Could I do something related to vision?" And I said, "No, I don't have anything related to vision, but we have a dysphagia study that we are just getting off the ground." And she said, "I don't know anything about dysphagia." And I said, "Well, I can tell you a little bit about it." 3 years later, she got a first author paper and another half dozen papers, and she just matched in neurology this year and wants to go into stroke. It has nothing to do with vision. So I don't know that, you know, she lost her interest in vision or vision science or ophthalmology, but you know, she really showed how well we can adapt to what our environment affords us. And there's just a lot in the environment in stroke as far as research.
I know you have some specific interest in stroke research. I was wondering if, just as a general comment for the listeners, what are you most excited about moving forward? You know, we just hear about stroke trial after stroke trial after stroke trial, and with different emphasis on different parts of what we care for. What are you looking forward to in the next 5 to 10 years that you think will come out that's really going to change the game for our patients?
Boy, what if I had a crystal ball? What am I looking forward to? You know, I honestly, I don't know. I think All of the new sexy toys and new pharmacologics that we have out there, I think that we're making more and more marginal gains if we were to collectively look at the benefit of, adding ticagrelor versus clopidogrel. There is a probably a real gain in intracranial atherosclerotic disease. I feel like there is. Whether we're using semaglutide versus teraglutide versus just metformin in our diabetic patients, there probably is some effect there, but it's going to be on the smaller side of things. I think that we're in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to be reframing a lot of our secondary prevention, not just in the field of pharmacotherapy, but I guess getting back to the basics with respect to diet and lifestyle, with the microbiome. I feel like I've been drinking this Kool-Aid on the microbiome for the last year as we've been submitting a couple of grants. There are so many downstream consequences of dysbiosis and pathologic gut flora on multiple, downstream consequences, whether it's atrial fibrillation or heightened platelet reactivity or endothelial inflammation. It seems like this is ripe for a, one drug fits all kind of model, and something that's very easy to fix. But again, we haven't explored that well enough to know that there's certainly one thing out there that can do that. We've thought about how resveratrol can modulate certain aspects of the gut microbiome with respect to, anti-inflammatory pathways and so on. And that doesn't seem to pan out, although it does affect the microbiome. And as you know more than most, Blake, the stroke literature is plagued with negative trials. So we have a lot of ways to go. I don't think, what's going to excite me down the road is going to be the next type of endovascular catheter or web device or, aneurysm detection software. I think there's a lot to be said about AI and, pre-hospital alerts and pre-hospital care. But I think that we need to be reminded of and focus on the basics. The reason why stroke risk declined in the US from, 8% to 4% over a 40-year period between 1960s and 2000s was related to aspirin and blood pressure reduction. Like, we're never going to get such a significant drop in risk reduction with any other intervention like we did with blood pressure control, just being aware of something so simple as that. So I think we have a lot more to learn, and I think we're going to go back to some of the basics and really think about how we can improve patients' compliance and adherence with medications, patients' follow-up, improve outpatient care, improve stroke awareness and education.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think to your point too, one of the things that I still look forward to is kind of some innovation around stroke recovery. Unfortunately, we just still can't treat everybody acutely. And I always say sometimes I wish stroke caused pain because I think a lot more people would recognize some signs and symptoms and come in a little bit quicker. But oftentimes these symptoms go unrecognized until it's a little bit too late for us to help with our acute stroke therapy. So I always get excited about new kind of recovery trials that come out and some new innovative things that people are using from a stroke recovery standpoint, even for the families. I think that caregiver support is potentially underutilized and under asked about with our stroke survivors because this is a big burden on families too that maybe we don't spend enough time on. And so I usually try to do some check-ins with my family members too to make sure that they have the resources that they need. And, even a simple, how are you doing to some of the caregivers goes a long way for some of our patients too.
Yeah, we focus so much on shortening that door to needle time for the 3 to 8% of patients that we give a lytic to. But what about the 97% of patients that go through their stroke treatment, their stroke course without receiving intravenous thrombolysis that we say, well, that was too little, too late. We're going to give you aspirin and Plavix or just aspirin. These secondary prevention and support systems that we probably neglect more than we care to admit are really a travesty. Patients require 40 hours or more of education, counseling, prognostication, guidance on how to navigate their post-stroke life within the first 3 months of being discharged. And we can't do that as a stroke neurologist. There's no way to bill for that. There's no way that we could provide that type of resource to patients. So rethinking a lot of these basic needs, I think, is going to be some of the forefront.
Jim, and also Blake, I feel like you both have provided a lot of very valuable insight into the special considerations and challenges of being a vascular neurologist. I'm wondering, Jim, as we wrap up our time together, if you can provide our listeners with a 1-minute elevator pitch for why they should consider vascular neurology as a subspecialty.
I think other than the field of epilepsy, or maybe even some aspects of traumatic brain injury, stroke is the one specialty where you see enormous impacts of disease coupled with enormous benefit and care. You'll see patients do a complete 180 in the hospital. You know, patients will go to the cath lab, paralyzed, unable to speak, and they'll come out of the cath lab, be extubated, and not know what happened, but be talking. And that type of situation just cannot be seen in any other subspecialty, in my opinion. I wouldn't go back and do anything else.
I love that answer. The last thing that we want to ask you about, and we're going to have to do a part two eventually to ask you more about your podcast, Brainwaves, because we're dying to learn more about it. We want to ask you about your no-brainers, and these are going to be 5 rapid-fire questions that you can respond to with one word or one sentence maximum. Jim, are you ready for your no-brainers?
Yes, let's do it.
What was your favorite part of this conversation?
Learning from you all about your experiences.
What is your favorite non-medical podcast to listen to?
Wait, don't tell me.
Best place to get a slice of deep dish pizza?
We're not really into deep dish here, actually. It's actually, don't tell anybody in Chicago. But I heard Pequot's is okay.
He's
we like Jimmy's
pizza.
He's
transplanted. He's a transplanted person.
This is true. This is true. Who do you contribute your success to?
I can't do this in one word. My mother.
2 words. And the last question we have, Jim, what are you most proud of?
My kids. It's cheesy, but it's true.
In this episode, we discuss the subspecialty of vascular neurology, the latest developments within the field, and special considerations and challenges when becoming a stroke neurologist. Thank you so much to our incredible guest, Dr. Jim Sigler, for joining us on the Neurophilia Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode of the Neurophilia Podcast, please leave us a review, share it with a friend, and follow us on Twitter at NeurophiliaPod. That's at NeurophiliaPod. For updates on more exciting episodes. See you next time.